Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
America has some catching up to do when it comes to solar energy. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We rank fifth in the world in solar installations behind Japan, Italy, China, and Germany, which right now has 11 times greater solar capacity per capita than we do. The good news is that we have developed good technology and we have vast amounts of land area and buildings on which we can install solar cells if we decide we want it and if public policy and private interests can align to get it done. Philip Warburg is former president of the environmental advocacy group, the Conservation Law Foundation. His new book is called Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. Philip, welcome to Think.
Great to be on your show.
Just a few years ago, you published a book called Harness the Wind about the great potential for wind energy generation in the United States, and you still think it's important. But at the time, you were less bullish on solar. So what changed for you?
Well, at the time when I was finishing my book on wind, the logical question people asked me was, will your next book be on solar? And my kind of flip response was, if I ever wrote a book about solar, I'd have to call it Dim Sun. Because at that time, the price of solar just seemed not to be suggesting that it would become a mainstream power resource anytime soon. I'm very happy to have been proven wrong. The price of solar has come down by about half since then. And we're really seeing a dramatic uptick in the use of solar. In fact, in the first 6 months of this year, 39% of all new electric generating capacity nationwide was solar, and another 36% was wind. So adding them together, you get to three-quarters of all new electric power generation capacity coming from two renewable energy resources. You know, we often think of gas as the transitional fuel, the cheaper fuel. Gas amounted to about 21% of new generating capacity during that six-month period. So we're really seeing solar take hold.
Why is solar getting cheaper?
Part of it is that the manufacturing is getting cheaper. We're getting the vast majority of our panels are coming from Asian countries, and most of them from China, about 60% from China. And we're also seeing the price of installation come way down. We're getting much more efficient at our implementation of solar at the residential level, at the commercial level, and at the utility scale. The so-called soft costs of solar installation, the marketing, the permitting, and the like, have a lot of wiggle room, and we're learning to really trim those costs, somewhat following on the German model, which has soft costs that amount to about 10% of our own soft cost for solar installation.
So you live in Massachusetts, which is decidedly less sunny than Texas. How did you decide to make the jump to installing solar panels in your home? And how long do you expect it'll take for your investment to pay for itself?
Well, one of the interesting things about Massachusetts is we're admittedly a chilly, snowy state, but we also actually are quite a sunny state. And one of the things that not too many people know about solar photovoltaics is that they actually work better in colder weather than in warmer weather. So we do quite well with our solar arrays that we put on our house. We installed them in 2013. We now get about 75% of our total household power needs from the solar array we installed. And we estimate that within 5 to 7 years of the time of installation, we will recoup our full investment.
For residential solar users, many people are aware that there's an option to lease the equipment. How does that work exactly, and what are the costs involved if you don't want to buy the system outright?
Well, there are two great alternatives to buying. One is leasing, and one is what is called a power purchase agreement. And in both cases, the solar company that installs your facility retains ownership, and in the case of leasing, you actually get all the power in exchange for a monthly lease payment that is agreed upon in advance. With the power purchase agreement, you agree to a certain rate that you will pay per kilowatt hour generated by the system on your roof. And there's no upfront cost. So it's a great way to bring solar to much greater numbers of people. Today, we have about 600,000 residential solar installations nationwide, and about 72% of those are either leased or are subject to a power purchase agreement.
So for a long time, when people had satellite dishes, the cable companies, if someone would move, they would say, just leave the little dish there, and then maybe we can sell service to the next person who comes along. Is that the way it works with leased solar equipment?
Yes, basically. There have been numerous studies done to evaluate what the advantage is to having solar on your home if you own it. It tends to increase the overall property value. If you change homes, the new owner does have to basically assume responsibility, whether it's a power purchase agreement or a lease.
I was surprised to learn how little effectiveness solar panels lose from one year to the next. They're still pretty good after a couple of decades.
That's right. They lose on average about 0.5% of their output per year. So you end up after 20, 30 years still with a very productive solar array, so long as other aspects of that technology don't break down.
And as a homeowner who's got this technology, do you have to, jump out on the roof 4 times a year and hose these things down and clean them? What is your maintenance obligation?
Well, we have solar on our house roof, and we also have it on our garage roof. Our house roof has a very steep 55-degree angle slope, which made for quite a challenge for the solar installers. I watched them install in total silence, and they said they'd never installed on that steep a roof. On our garage, which I actually can reach with a snow rake, mm-hmm. I did very carefully rake off some snow this winter because we had enormous amounts of snow. I do not have to hose down the solar arrays. Occasional rains are sufficient, and we've had very productive solar panels for the past 2+ years.
There are still people, as I'm sure you're aware, Philip, who think solar's a good idea, but continue to hold off, assuming that, 5 years from now, things will be even cheaper, even better than they are today. Does that make sense?
Well, there are a couple of factors, I think. One, there is currently in place a federal investment tax credit for solar. It's a 30% tax credit that is applicable to residential, commercial, and utility-scale solar. Unfortunately, that tax credit is slated to sunset as of the end of 2016 for residential installations and drop from 30% to 10% for commercial and utility scale installations. So that's an advantage to acting now. We're hoping to see that investment tax credit renewed, as it's a very important counterweight to the very large subsidies we've seen given to oil, gas, nuclear over decades. But there's no guarantee that will be the case. Solar technology will improve. How quickly it improves and how that will affect cost are open questions right now. There are technologies that are much more efficient. The panels on our house get probably about 18 to 19% efficiency in terms of capturing the sun's light. There are panels that are in the experimental stage that get 44-45% efficiency, but they're much, much more, they're not marketable yet, but they would be much more expensive. So it's a question of whether we can afford to wait in terms of the climate. We need to take action now to reduce our carbon footprint, and I think waiting for perfection would be a catastrophic error.
Will market forces alone ever be sufficient to drive those who have the choice, for whom the financial outlay is not a problem, to pick solar?
I think it depends a lot on what region you're talking about and what the, for example, the retail rate of power is in a given area. One thing that makes solar more desirable in a place like Massachusetts is that the retail rate for electricity is quite high. That's not so much the case in Texas, for example. Texas has a fairly shockingly little amount of solar installed so far. And I think part of that is that the electricity that you have there is much cheaper. I think part of it is also that there are certain state policies that are not in place in Texas that have discouraged people from investing in solar.
Yeah, there are other kinds of power that we are very excited about here in Texas, yeah. As you are well aware.
Yes.
You know, I've heard it before, but it always takes me by surprise that Germany is the world leader in per capita solar generation.
Germany made a strategic decision back in the 90s that renewable energy should be a major part of its power supply. I think we've seen a lot of enlightenment come out of Europe that we would do very well to follow in terms of addressing the challenge of our greenhouse gas emissions before it's too late. And they introduced in the late 90s a 100,000 roofs solar program with tariffs that were favorable to solar. And today they get about 7% of their total electricity from the sun. We're talking about a cloudy, rainy state. So you can imagine how much more favorable Texas would be as a climate for solar, for example, than Germany. But Germany is proving that solar can be viable if policies make it a priority.
Not that this is necessarily an impediment for many people, but have all those roof-mounted panels changed the look of German cityscapes?
I think one of the things that we really need to do is develop a 21st century aesthetic regarding energy technology. It's true of wind, and I think it's true of solar. You can look at a wind turbine and say, oh, we don't want to industrialize our viewshed, or you can look at wind turbines and say, this is an amazing technology that is capturing a boundless and clean energy resource. And I think the same is true for solar. Our house happens to be a Victorian home built in 1880. When we put solar on our roof, I was frankly nervous that our neighbors were going to exercise anxiety about it. All we got was curiosity from our neighbors, which I frankly was delighted to hear. And I think, are solar panels visible? They are visible. I personally see them as an enhancement because I think about what they're providing and I just don't look at them simply for their visual impact, which frankly I think is fairly minimal on many houses.
Is it likely that at some point solar panels will be developed that, or solar cells will be developed that are practically invisible from the perspective of people sort of walking down the street or driving down the street? Could we make roofing materials that contain solar elements?
The answer is yes. There is a very active effort to commercialize roof tiles right now that are solar. They're much more expensive. There's also a lot of investigation going on into embedding photovoltaics in windows, which could be a great innovation. I think, again, those are wonderful innovations when their time comes, but we have a very functional technology today that we should go forward with and then build upon that technology as we move into the future. Right now, solar power provides only about 0.5% of our total power needs nationwide. So even if we go forward vigorously with conventional solar technology and 10, 15 years from now, that technology improves, we need to take solar to a wholly new level. And that can include existing technology and it can include innovations going forward. I should mention that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, a government laboratory, did a study called Renewable Electricity Futures a couple years ago, and it projected that we could be getting 0.5% of our total power needs from the sun and the wind by 2050 using technology that is commercially available today.
Wow.
So is the technology today perfect? Perhaps not, but it is certainly capable of meeting a huge percentage of our power needs.
Philip Warburg is my guest. He's former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and author of the new book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Philip Warburg, author of the new book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. You can join us on Twitter. My handle is at Chris Boyd Think. Phil, in this part of Texas, we get some really horrific hailstorms, and it seems like every few years, whatever neighborhood you live in is likely to take a hit. So we have a tweet here from Rajesh who says, how does solar hold up to hailstorms, and what happens if you have to replace your roof?
I visited Phoenix, Arizona, where they have had a few very significant hailstorms. And what I heard was that while there was a lot of damage done to buildings, the solar arrays were basically remained intact. So they're quite resistant. They're very strong pieces of equipment, even though they are made of glass. And so I think that should not be a major concern.
Until now in this conversation, we have focused on solar panels that are installed on buildings. But of course, there are lots of ways to do this, including putting solar power capturing equipment out in the wilderness. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the efforts that you have learned about, some of the places that you visited where this is being done?
Yes. About a fifth of our total power needs could come from rooftop solar alone. So that's a wonderfully expansive resource that we've only begun to scratch the surface of. But it is cheaper to build what is called utility-scale solar power, large fields of solar power. It's about half the price of, for example, a residential array. And that is happening in many areas. There are growing concerns about the use of open spaces for solar, and I think there are a couple of things that need to happen. One, start with open spaces that are not considered high-value natural areas. So fallow farmland, for example, is a great possible venue for solar, and we're seeing that develop in many different contexts. Take California as an example. California is the nation's leader in solar power, and California is also a place where 250,000 acres are grown or are planted in cotton still. So one could imagine a major portion of that resource shifting over to generating power as opposed to consuming huge amounts of water, which is what cotton does in a state that is afflicted with chronic drought. One can develop solar on natural areas, and I did visit several sites. For example, the California Valley Solar Ranch. It's in San Luis Obispo County, which and the area is the Carrizo Plain, sometimes referred to somewhat generously as California's Serengeti. It does have a fair amount of wildlife. And when the developers of this project set about constructing the project, they took great pains to relocate various species that were considered vulnerable, the San Joaquin kit fox, the giant kangaroo rat. And what they have done is once the plant was built, they allowed these species to reintegrate with the facility. They also built migratory carters through the solar fields for elk and antelope, and they set aside some 12,000 acres in permanent conservation. This is for a facility that generates enough electricity for 100,000 California households. So it's a very large facility, is making a real dent in that area's greenhouse gas emissions, and wildlife management was given real priority. There's a tribe called the Moapah Band of Paiutes in Nevada, and when they're now still constructing a solar facility, a very large facility, also targeting about 100,000 households, and they have relocated about 75 desert tortoise, a threatened species, and very carefully gave them monitoring devices, and they found that the relocation was overwhelmingly successful. There was one mortality due to a coyote attack, which could have happened anywhere. And so one needs to take pains to protect wildlife values. But I think that we need to regard our open spaces as a potential solar resource if we use those open spaces wisely. It is true that some land conservation groups are now saying, you know, we shouldn't be industrializing our landscape, while renewable energy advocates are saying, but we need to move away from fossil fuels. And that means that we need to seriously engage the various contexts within which solar power can be developed. Another great resource for solar is brownfield solar, that is building solar on industrial sites. They might be former landfills, they might be former factory sites. I visited one of these sites in Chicago. I visited several, but one that I visited was in Chicago on the south side in the West Pullman neighborhood, a very high crime area. International Harvester used to assemble its farm equipment there, abandoned the site in the 1980s, and it was left vacant and polluted for many years until Exelon came in and built the Exelon City Solar Facility about 5 years ago. And that site now generates enough electricity for about 1,500 households and has turned what was a safety hazard, an environmental menace, and a visual blight into a positive energy resource.
Okay, we've had a couple of email questions that I'm going to put together here about the possibility of putting solar panels on top of our cars and the possibility of this technology of making solar-powered roads or solar-gathering roads.
One of the things to keep in mind about solar is that the sun is a diffuse resource. As one solar developer said to me, we're lucky it is so diffuse, otherwise we would all be fricasseed. And I think that speaks to, you know, how significant solar could be if we mounted it on our car roofs. Yes, it could generate a small amount of electricity and recharge, let's say, an electric vehicle battery in part. But I don't think we should exaggerate how much of a power boost we would get from those rooftop arrays. So I don't think it's the most efficient use of solar. But if the price of solar comes down and it's an added amenity to a car that is costing in the tens of thousands of dollars in any case, no harm done. I wouldn't want to bank on that getting us to a sustainable energy future, but it's an interesting idea. I have similar concerns about solar roads in that roads take a huge beating from cars, trucks, buses, etc. And at least in Massachusetts, those roads spend a good amount of the year covered in snow or slush or dirt. And I'm not at all convinced that that is the most promising next way to go either. I think that we have plenty of opportunities, again, on our brownfields, on warehouse rooftops, on residential rooftops, and on farmlands, that those are probably the places we should really be focusing our efforts right now.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. James is on the line in Duncanville. Hi, James.
Hello. I really like the ebook, and I'd like to thank the author for writing it and Ms. Boyd for today's program. I was happy to read that Mr. Warburg has both a solar array and a plug-in electric vehicle. What I'd like you to comment on is, what do you see the role today for grassroots advocacy efforts, such as the DFW Solar Tour, which is the local version of the American Solar Energy Society's National Solar Tour, and it's taking place on Saturday, October 3rd, in furthering the growth of local distributed solar and electric vehicles when there are so many commercial companies promoting both distributed and utility-scale solar? And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I think we need to see advocacy happening at all levels. We need a robust advocacy effort to extend the federal investment tax credit. We need advocacy at the state level to get net metering policies adopted that will allow homeowners and businesses to recoup the full retail value of solar power that they are generating from their arrays. And I should mention that Texas does not have a statewide net metering policy, so that's something that your listeners should pay attention to.
Can you explain what that means before you move on? Net metering policy.
Yes. So in our home, we generate on average 75% of our total power needs over the course of the year. There are certain months where we generate a surplus of power, and there are certain months where we generate less than 75% of our power needs. When we are generating a surplus of power, net metering allows our meter basically to spin backwards, and it reduces the overall number of kilowatt hours that we are charged by our utility. That's a very important incentive for solar owners so that you are actually able to benefit from the solar power you're generating, even if you're not using that solar power at that point in time. And some 46 states plus the District of Columbia have some form of net metering. It's a very important incentive that should move forward in all states. In terms of grassroots advocacy at the local level, I think there's a lot that can be done. Various communities still have ordinances that prohibit, for example, solar panels or other visible encroachments upon roof space. One of the ironies I encountered was with an official of NRG Energy who was touring me through Gillette Stadium and Patriot Place here in Massachusetts, showing me the NFL's commitment to solar power. And I asked him if he had solar power on his home in Texas. I believe it was Dallas. And he said his community basically has a homeowners association that bars solar on rooftops. So here he is doing wonderful work promoting solar energy on various scales, but can't even put it on his own household. So one of the things is to make sure that there are ordinances in place that allow for solar power. And to take it a step beyond that, there are some communities that now require solar power on every new residential unit built, for example. In Lancaster, California, all new units either have to have solar on them or they have to have off-site solar that is dedicated to providing solar power to those new residential units. So I think that we have to get engaged at whatever level we feel we're best connected to. And the listener is right that distributed solar generation is a very, very important part of the transformation that we are undergoing today. It's the part that really threatens utilities most, because what it is doing is generating power on home roofs, on business roofs, and the like, and reducing the overall number of kilowatt hours that a given electricity provider can sell. And utilities are getting very nervous because they are very used to the model of selling electrons rather than selling electricity services. So they are going to have to undergo a transformation in order not to be left out in the cold. We have warnings of companies like Kodak and Polaroid where they didn't catch on to the digital era in time. And I think utilities are going to have to wake up and say, well, we need to start providing smart storage of electric power, because solar power, for example, is variable. It's not available all the time. Same thing with wind. There's a certain degree of complementarity between solar and wind, but we need a much smarter, better modulated grid and overall management of our electric generating infrastructure to accommodate a much higher degree of solar and wind integration. So those are all steps that I think we really are going to need to take. And we need to recognize that it's not simply an incremental move. It is a fundamental transformation in the way we generate and use electricity.
Phil, what have you learned about how companies make decisions about their investments in solar technology? You know, you mentioned stadiums. There are big box stores and factories and flower shops and, you know, businesses all over the country that are deciding to put solar arrays on their roofs.
Solar really pays off in many, many contexts. And, for example, Walmart has installed solar on 250 of its buildings. Its goal is to have solar on 1,000 of its buildings, and eventually its goal is to be 100% reliant upon renewable energy for its electricity. I visited a warehouse in New Jersey, the White Rose Warehouse, which gets 90% of its total power needs from the sun. And this is a very, very large, quarter-mile-long food storage warehouse, high energy use. But with solar on its rooftop, it is generating its power needs very substantially and at an affordable rate. There are lots of examples of companies that are generating solar electricity, either because they own the systems or, again, because of third-party power purchase agreements, where they're paying substantially less for that solar power than they're paying for their utility-provided electricity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Terry in Dallas. Hey, Terry.
Hi. Good morning. I In addition, just back to the advocacy issue for a moment, I know that the Department of Energy funds what's called the Solar Decathlon every other year here in the States, and then in the off years over in Europe, for university teams to develop completely solar-powered prototype homes. I was just curious if Mr. Warburg has attended the Decathlon or if he talks about it in his book at all.
I admire what the Decathlon has done. I actually have not attended a Decathlon, but there are lots and lots of examples of zero net energy buildings that are being constructed across the country. And I think that the Decathlon's a great way to bring into higher profile those innovative building technologies. My wife is an architect, and I hear a lot from her about the transformation that is happening in the building industry, which is absolutely fantastic. One of the great things about solar, frankly, is that it is so visible, whether it's on your home or your neighbor's home, or you've seen it on a local office complex or on a parking canopy. Most people encounter solar as part of their daily lives. So what the Decathlon is doing is very important, but so is just looking at the rooftops of the buildings that you're walking by or driving by.
In terms of there are things like stoplights and other traffic signals that sometimes you'll see have a little solar power. Those kinds of technologies still have to be attached to a power source, though, right? Because there isn't a great way to store solar energy when it's not being used. We haven't come quite that far with batteries yet. Am I right about that?
Yeah, technically, you could have a battery large enough to store sufficient power in those kinds of decentralized locations, lithium-ion batteries, for example. The practical matter is that it is cheaper and probably wiser to be connected to the grid as a backup resource right now. There's a great deal of research going into power storage at the household level, at the business level, at the utility scale, and we will be moving more and more in that direction. I think one of the promising things about electric vehicles is that they provide a huge potential battery resource that can double as storage and as mobility facilitation. And that's what we're just beginning to see as well, where we can be using our electric vehicles.
I got to jump in here. I'm sorry. My guest is Philip Warburg. We're talking about his new book, Harness the Sun. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Philip Warburg, former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and author of the new book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. Phil, before the break, you were finishing up telling us that electric vehicles, plug-in vehicles, can actually be used as a means of storing excess power and providing power in the event of some kind of a deficit in the home solar system.
Yes. When we think of our motor vehicles, the average car is probably driven an hour or maybe two per day. So that means that if you have a plug-in electric vehicle, that vehicle is sitting idle for 22 to 23 hours a day. It only takes a few hours to actually charge the vehicle. So if a utility, for example, can control when the vehicle is being charged, and if the utility can also decharge that battery in the case of a grid that is lacking in sufficient electricity generation, you have a very versatile double use of battery technology. Battery technology isn't cheap, but if it's being used both for mobility and for balancing out the grid on the basis of smart controls, it becomes a much more viable technology. You know, if we're looking at tens of millions of electric vehicles, for example, we could imagine that being a very significant contributor to a balanced power supply. And when we think of solar, again, we need to think about how we're going to balance it with, for example, wind. And West Texas is a good example right now. West Texas has a huge amount of wind energy already in place. If it developed solar, it could be a very complementary resource because the winds tend to blow more at night. The sun obviously shines during the day. So the same grid infrastructure that Texas has spent about $7 billion building, largely for transporting wind from West Texas to major cities, could be used also for supporting a utility-scale solar investment in that same area. One great example of balancing the grid is what has happened between Denmark and Norway. Denmark now gets 40% of its power from wind. Denmark has a surplus of hydro capacity. So when Denmark is generating too much power, it wheels that power to Norway. Norway pumps water into a storage reservoir. It's called a pumped storage technology. And then when the power is needed back on the grid, let's say in Denmark or elsewhere in Europe, it can run that water back through turbines and generate electricity to help balance out the grid. So all of these kinds of steps need to be taken to build a smarter, more responsive electric generating and storage and use technology.
When solar panels, are installed in a remote location, how much energy is lost in transit, between the place where it's generated and the place where people actually need power?
In general, about 0.5% per 100 miles is lost in transmission. So if you have a very strong renewable energy resource, whether it's wind or solar, in a somewhat remote location, it probably is going to still be worth your while to build utility scale solar or wind in that location and then absorb the losses, knowing that even after those losses, you'll be delivering a lot of renewable energy to a major population center, let's say like Los Angeles.
I want to give you an update, by the way. You mentioned earlier that you spoke to somebody who was in the solar, was trying to promote solar in at a stadium, couldn't have it in his home here in Texas. Our producer, Stephen Becker, found this. Residential developments with more than 50 homes cannot ban or restrict homeowners from installing solar panels, even while new homes are still being built. And that's according to some legislation recently signed into law by Governor Greg Abbott, and that actually went into effect September 1st. So perhaps your colleague can now get solar panels on his home if it's still something he's interested in. So thought we'd
That's wonderful news.
Yeah.
I hope he has more than 50 homes in his particular residential community, but that's very, very good news.
Yeah, we'll cross our fingers for that. Okay, we have Christopher on the line now in Denton. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I just had a question about the environmental impacts of harvesting the materials required for solar panels, and if that is something that's going to be a problem when this scales as solar gains more momentum, and then also if biotechnology, power of natural chlorophyll in algae and things like that would be a really good alternative.
Thanks for your call.
Photovoltaics tend to come in two varieties. One are crystalline silicon, and the other are thin film. Crystalline silicon photovoltaics really rely essentially upon silicon, which is a very, very commonly occurring mineral. And there is use, obviously, of some metal framing and some silver or copper soldering. But basically, there are not rare resources that are being consumed by photovoltaics in the silicon crystalline silicon variety. Thin film photovoltaics use some small amounts of some toxic substances, and for that reason, there is a significant focus now on not so much the manufacture, which is not a problem, but the proper and safe recycling and disposal of solar technology at the end of its useful life. Here, too, Europe provides an inspiring example. There is a waste directive, an electronic waste directive, that includes solar panels. And right now, and they must ramp up the provision of free recycling for solar panels. I think it gets to 80% by 2018. And as it's a new industry, we're seeing those percentages go up in concert with the use of the technology. And the vast majority of materials used in solar panels can be safely recycled. So that's an encouraging move. In terms of biotechnology, frankly, it's not an area of my expertise, but what I'd like to say is the president often talks about our need for an all-of-the-above energy policy. I would modify that in terms of an all-of-the-above renewable energy policy, and there may be biotechnology applications that should be developed as well. I would not say as an alternative to, but I would say as a supplement to solar and wind.
Green jobs, of course, has become a sort of catchphrase in America. How many jobs have been created by the growing solar energy industry? And is it worth our while to try to compete with China to become the leading global manufacturer of solar cells?
About 174,000 jobs are now provided by the solar industry in America today. The vast majority of those jobs are not in manufacturing. They are in the development of solar projects, whether on the household scale, the commercial scale, or the utility scale. And there's a big question as to whether how we should compete in the manufacturing sector. Manufacturing isn't just about manufacturing panels. It's also about manufacturing inverters that convert the direct current produced by a solar panel to alternating current. It's about the mounting mechanisms that are used. And America is quite involved in manufacturing things other than solar panels. It is having a tough time competing with Asian producers of the panels and the cells themselves. And I think what we need to do is think about our manufacturing niche as developing cutting-edge new technologies rather than mass-producing standard fare solar panels, because I think it will be very hard for us to compete in that latter market. I also think we need to think about an integrated approach to manufacturing and development so that a solar panel manufacturer isn't just looking at the bottom line in terms of the panels manufactured, but is looking at the overall implementation and development of solar on commercial rooftops and on a utility scale, for example.
Back to the phones now. Greg is on the line in Dallas. Hello, Greg.
Good afternoon. I have an observation and a thought to pass on. I've always been an advocate of ground-mounting PV for residential. It gives so much better access for cleaning, maintenance, and maybe the cosmetic objections from your neighbors if that be a problem on your roof. So thoughts on that?
Ground mounting is more expensive, and also, very frankly, in many, many parts of the country, including where I live in Boston, Massachusetts, there isn't much available land for ground-mounted solar. It certainly can work in many parts of the country. It is cheaper simply to put panels on an existing structure, such as a roof. Wouldn't rule it out, but I wouldn't make it as the first step to be taken in bringing solar to scale.
Many people are aware that this company, Solyndra, received a federal loan guarantee to produce solar panels and then proceeded in pretty short order to go bankrupt. Is that an argument against government intervention in favor of solar energy, solar technology?
I think Solyndra has been much used and abused by opponents of solar power to say that the entire loan guarantee program somehow was flawed. The idea of the loan guarantee program was to help launch a nascent technology, and the assumption was that there would be certain failures along the way. Solyndra failed. It failed in part because it was developing an expensive technology that presumed a very high price for silicon. The price for silicon came way down, and Asian producers came into the picture, and Solyndra really couldn't compete. It failed. And it cost the government about $500 million. The overall program is about a $30 billion program, and the loan guarantee program was actually instrumental in getting utility-scale solar off the ground because private financial investment houses were not touching utility-scale solar back in 2009, 2010. It just seemed too new and too risky. And what happened was the loan guarantee program stepped in, provided loan guarantees to a number of utility-scale projects. And today, utility-scale solar is a huge contributor to our overall solar power supply. So it really transformed the solar industry. And in the same way, the investment tax credits have helped give people a sense of security in going forward with solar investments, again, providing something of an even playing field with energy technologies that have long been very heavily subsidized and whose subsidies are very seldom questioned in the way that solar subsidies are questioned.
So what do you see as the biggest impediments to a large-scale conversion to solar so that we could get that? Did you say it was 30% by 2050 power from the sun?
What I said was that solar and wind together could provide 50%.
Okay.
And I think 30% solar is a realistic ambition if we were to adopt the right kinds of policies and get very serious about investing in solar technology and in renewable technology in general. So I think that we could be moving in that direction if we decided that it was called for. One of the, I think, interesting and hopeful aspects of the Obama Clean Power Plan is that it leaves it to states to determine how to achieve the reductions in carbon emissions that are required for those states. And part of that strategy can be the implementation of a vigorous renewable energy investment strategy.
Is this season of cheap petroleum hampering the progress of these efforts?
It actually is not, because back in the, let's say, 60s and 70s, we were getting a pretty substantial percentage of our electricity from oil. Today, we get less than 1% of our electricity from oil. So it really isn't a significant player in the electric market. And I don't really think it's having an impact.
So when you are in your mostly solar-powered home, is anything different about your experience of hanging out there than it was before?
Well, I think one great thing that it does is it makes you much more aware of the power you're generating and the power you're consuming. Hmm. So, for example, we have not used our clothes dryer in the last 2 years, and our daughters are finding that an inspirational model. They're understanding that you don't take power for granted, and they're actually getting a little bit better about turning off lights behind them. So I think it is a consciousness-raising tool, and it is a sense of satisfaction in taking charge of a substantial portion of the power that we consume.
But otherwise, everything kind of works the way it always did.
Absolutely. No difference whatsoever, because those electrons that we aren't using go back into the grid. So there's really no disruption or impact upon our own household supply of electricity.
Philip Warburg is former president of the Conservation Law Foundation, and he is author of the new book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. Phil, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.